Welcome to The Spoken Nerd, the podcast about database technology. I'm your host, Connor McDonald, and in this episode, I continue talking to Maria Colgan, a distinguished product manager from Oracle Corporation, to talk about the role she's perhaps most known for, that is, of the Optimizer product manager. We'll talk about the Optimizer and some of our likes and dislikes, but most of all, just chew the fat about what makes the Oracle technology great. I hope you enjoy this episode, and let's dive straight into it. Was your first product manager role with the Optimizer?
It wasn't. I actually joined the generic data warehousing team. It became evident as we were going through it that more and more of the questions and concerns and issues folks were having were around the Optimizer. Because back in the day, the general feeling was they don't need to know anything. You know, customers don't need to know anything about the Optimizer. It's supposed to just work and it'll work just fine. You know, when we transition from rule-based to cost-based, it's going to be just fine. Here's 10 simple rules. Wasn't really working anymore. And there was a bunch of stuff you need to do, like gather stats, understand if I need a histogram, I don't need a histogram. All of those kind of things were starting to come up, and plan stability was beginning to become a bigger and bigger concern for customers. And so it was more of an evolution, really.
Into the variations on the Optimizer and the fact that it was, we originally pitched the Optimizer, both rule and cost, as effectively, as you said, almost like a black box. You don't need to worry about it. SQL goes in, great plans come out. Not to put on my Oracle hat too strongly here, I actually believe, especially nowadays, that's pretty close to the truth. It's funny how people do love to find those outlying examples and then say, oh, you know, the Optimizer should handle this, etc. But in terms of the Optimizer being a black box, I saw recently at your Cloud World presentation, you did a talk, Harnessing the Power of Optimizer Hints. And a good friend of ours, Tanel Poder on Twitter, posed the question. He said, this seems to be a change of tactic from Oracle in terms of publicizing things about hints and Optimizer internals. What are your thoughts on that? Have we had a definite shift in focus to exposing more about how the Optimizer works? And maybe the word is not encouraging, but certainly informing people about things like Optimizer hints.
I think inevitably people are going to use them anyway, right? As soon as there's any whiff or hint of, excuse the pun, something, a mechanism that you can use to influence some part of Oracle, then people are all excited about it. And one of the reasons we started the blog way back when, the Optimizer Magic blog and eventually the blog on oracle.com, was because other people were blogging about it and it wasn't always correct. So it was more of a forcing function of other people's interest in that area that drove the Optimizer team and myself to begin those blogs and to begin to share. And then as the more we shared and the more people understood how it worked, the more comfortable the team in general and the management became with explaining things like hints and stuff like that. The funny thing is, the Cloud World folks approached me and asked for that particular session only because I had done it multiple years, like 5 or 6 years ago at Open World, the precursor to Cloud World, and it had been a very popular session. So it's not immediately new, so to speak. I don't want to make it sound like last year we decided we'd be open about it. We've actually been opening the kimono a little bit wider for quite some time around the Optimizer and stuff. But the hints are out there. People know about them. They're blogged about all the time. So you might as well tell people exactly how it works so that they don't get themselves into too much trouble.
You don't want to shoot themselves in the foot, so to speak. Interestingly, we now document these SQL hints in the SQL language reference manual. Not all the hints are in there. And I know if you go look in a VDOLA view inside the database, you can see them. I'm curious, do you have any involvement, or do you know how we make those decisions as to which ones are documented and which ones are not? Now, there are obviously some in there that are very much purely designed only ever for internal use, and that's why they're not documented. But there's others that I know that are very much out there in the wild, yet we still have the decision not to document them.
And imagine what that might be that you're thinking of.
Oh, I'm thinking like things like the materialize hint, used everywhere, but not in the documentation. Do you consider that documentation oversight, or is there a gray area where there are hints that everyone's using, but we don't put in the documentation as our mechanism of saying we'd rather you didn't use them?
Yeah, I think, if we documented all of them, it'd be an incredibly overwhelming volume of information that 99% of the people wouldn't need 99% of the time. So it definitely, the decision to document fewer, the more obvious ones and the ones that we thought people might need the most, I want an index instead of a table scan. I want a nested loop instead of a hash, or I want a hash instead of a nested loop. Things like that, they were the hints that we documented, the ones that we thought folks would need more readily. Ones that influence transformations and things like that, when they should happen and when they shouldn't happen. There was less of a push to document those, because that should all happen automatically. And really and truly, those ones were introduced simply to allow us to test the plan with and without the transformation kicking in. And the decision to use it or not should be done by the optimizer based on cost and efficiency. So that was part of the reason why. You'd have to ask Nigel now. I'm not going to speak on his behalf about whether it's an oversight or deliberate documentation choice about the ones that are docked now. But certainly when we began documenting, that was the thought process.
You mentioned in that talk also, in terms of looking at when hints are used and the like, and there was some new facilities in 19C onwards that let you see what hints are being either in error or unused, etc. You also talked about the 10053 trace file. What are your thoughts on the future of trace files in terms of, in our cloud environments, you can still get some of them. You can turn on a SQL trace now and autonomous, although you don't get weights, which I think is not such a good idea. I think we'll fix that at some stage. But there are only some trace facilities available, but we haven't blocked it all together. Do you think trace files are going to go away, or are they a necessary evil, so to speak?
I think they're a necessary evil, but there has been an initiative internally to try and clean them up. We've gotten a little bit loosey-goosey with our trace files and perhaps spitting out far too much information. Those who've examined alert logs, for example, recently might feel that way too, that we're becoming oversharers in everything that's in there and perhaps having a more boiled down version of that information with just the critical details there. So I think you'll see a move in the next couple of releases in that direction. I don't think trace files are ever going to go away. We need them ourselves for diagnosability. But I do think that they will hopefully become more precise and not so chatty Cathy as they've become.
I have to admit, one of the cool initiatives from, I think it's 21, not 23, yeah, 21 onwards, can't say 23 yet. One of the cool initiatives is the attention log. I know that, yeah, every DBA under the sun has written some 512-line awk script in their day to parse the nuggets of information out of the alert log. And as you said, each release, we've been putting more and more stuff in there. And I should say, with the best intentions, most of the stuff I see in the alert log that's evolved over time has been more wordy, such that people could actually read it more easily. But of course, those sort of old school DBAs who are all about parsing, they're like, this is making life very, very difficult. I remember even way back in Oracle 9, DBAs were up in arms when we started logging snapshot two olds to the alert log, because we logged the SQL statement in there and people were saying alert log should be one line of text per line, with a date stamp and that's it. So the attention log, which is that nice, concise, XMLized version, I think is a real bonus in 21C. People should point their parsers at that and they'll be much, much happier. One last thing on 10053 trace. A little bit of a contentious one here. I was poking through a 10053 trace recently, and a lot of the dictionary queries still have the rule hint in them. And people on the Twitter sphere and the intertubes take great delight in posting internal dictionary queries with the rule hint and calling us hypocrites. I actually have no problem with them in the sense that if it's not broke, don't fix it. If I've got a dictionary query which is run a billion times a day because people refuse to use bind variables, then I'd rather not touch that code. If it's been working for 35 years, I'm pretty sure it's working pretty well. But is it worth the exercise of gaining some social clout, so to speak, to look at removing rule hints from our dictionary queries? Or is it to just leave it and suffer the consequences of Twitter ire?
It's a really good question. I know when we had customers come to us, when we made a big push in 8 and 9 of deprecating the rule-based optimizer, everybody was moving to the cost base. We weren't evolving it any further. We did have a couple of these kind of heart-to-heart with customers about, is it worth the migration or not? And there was a pretty good set of guidance given at the time by the head of the optimizer team, Mohammed Zait, told them, if you don't intend to evolve this application at all, if it's frozen in time as is, and you're never going to add partitioning, parallel execution, all these things that the rule-based optimizer knows nothing about, then it's not worth the effort to migrate it to the cost-based optimizer. I think you'll notice that too with those dictionary views. over the years, those that have evolved to need things like perhaps partitioning under the covers to improve the performance and stuff like that, the rule-based hints are being removed from those and they switch over to using the cost-based. For those that are kind of boilerplate, never changing, this is the best way to access it via this index and the rule-based hint is there for a reason, I reckon there is no initiative to change those anytime soon. So yeah, it is slowly evolved. There's not as many rule-based hints as there were, but if it ain't broke, don't fix it, I think is pretty much going to be the answer for that one.
And I imagine the gain versus risk is probably the thing that's going to kill that conversation. Yeah. If I put an enhancement request into our bug dev database and go, yeah, the thing that accesses tab dollar for table information, I think we should tweak it to remove the rule hint. I get the feeling there'll be people standing well back from me going, yeah, Connor, you go ahead and do that and let us know how it works out for you.
Exactly. Let us know how you get on. That would be me. I'd definitely be one of the people standing back going, let's see if this blows up. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, the acronym CLM, Career Limiting Move. I'm returning to LinkedIn here for your part of your synopsis. We've covered the first sentence of your career synopsis. Now we're going to move on to the second one. I find great satisfaction in listening to and incorporating the needs of customers into future product releases. I'm not going to dispute that. Don't worry. I'm not going to say that doesn't sound right. No. I'm going to explore it in terms of there was a time when the only way you can get in touch with Oracle was via a phone call to metalink.oracle.com back in the day. Obviously, things have changed. What do you think is the best way for customers to get feedback to us in the sense that we now have so many channels? And some of those channels are what you would call non-official. They're just social media channels. So obviously, people can log SRs. But in terms of the best way for us to receive feedback from customers, what do you think the role of social media plays in that?
You know, it's like every industry. I don't know about you, but I typically don't tweet or flag any other company unless I'm having a moan about something that's wrong with them, right? You messed up my travel arrangements or you messed up something on me. And then suddenly I'm quite willing to do, dear Mr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so, you've messed up. So definitely social media, we do get some of that. And I've actually gotten some really good, genuine enhancement requests that way, as well as plenty of moaning. But generally for customer feedback, there are some official channels that we've got, right? So there is the customer advisory boards, programs like Global Leaders, where it's companies where we're working very closely hand in hand, being able to influence the next version of the database. Forums is another great place too, where people have been able to give us their feedback as well over the years. But if you truly do have something and you want it logged or mentioned or brought to our attention, social media is a good way to do it. Reach out to one of the product managers or even at Oracle and let them know, or at Oracle Database more specifically, and let us know. You can definitely get some attention that way. But as I said, a lot of it comes through the CABs and those closer relationships with customers.
I'm going to get a lot of PMs offside here. Do you think it's a good idea for all PMs to be on social media and every single one of them to have their DMs open such that any customer can send them messages at any time? Not that they need to respond, but just always have that available point of contact, because it used to be email, but obviously nowadays email is almost out of favor in the sense that one in every 10 emails is valid content. The other nine are trying to get you a better mortgage, a cheaper credit card, or a larger piece of anatomy.
I'll leave that one, alone for sure. So certainly I've always been open and people have reached out to me via email, no bother. Honestly, it'd be great if we could get everybody on social media. I know people have very strong personal preferences about that. Some people, thinking it's the work of the devil, other people considering it just a general distraction or whatever. I think it is good. It is a great way for us to be able to share content out, but also to receive insight from our customers or requests for help or concerns. So honestly, I would think, and at this stage, I think you'll find all of the product managers on one of the platforms. What you won't find is all of the product managers on all of the platforms. LinkedIn seems to be a favorite of a lot of them. So you can definitely find most of, if not all of them there.
What is your process for, I know one of the risks of being on social media is dealing with negativity. And as you said, I'm just as much to blame here. Like I'm often on Twitter sitting there going, can we keep it nice and positive? And then the next time I'm like, God damn it, airline. God damn it, shopping company. God damn it, courier, et cetera. And I'm going off about, you know, why something didn't arrive or something was cancelled, et cetera. So I'm firmly putting my hypocrite hat on here. But in terms of dealing with negativity, because people do get very animated sometimes about particular issues with the Oracle database, how do you not take it personally?
Anybody who says, I don't ever take any of it personally, it's all good, I think is lying. I certainly haven't not taken some of it personally, but what I have learned to do, and only by those that I, you know, respect in my life telling me, just put the phone down. I want to say that just put the phone down, don't do the response there where you're heated about it, and go back and just look at what's being asked and try and answer it without the emotion in it. And for me, that requires potentially some amount of time. So if you get a delay in your question or feedback from me on social media, perhaps it's because the first couple of responses were deleted or the phone was put down, because to stop it being personal. Because at the end of the day, you know yourself, somebody's frustrated, something didn't work, they're in a pickle and they're just taking the stress out on you. But it's, I don't know anybody who doesn't take some of it personally some of the time. It's kind of hard not to.
I have to admit, I do my absolute best. I keep telling myself, if they're this angry, it means they're hurting. But I have to admit, I'd love to say that, and I take this, you know, philanthropic view to my response, but that's not always the case.
It's hard not to come back with the gut response.
As much as I would hate to be shilling money into Elon Musk's coffers by paying, you know, the $8 a month, whatever it is, to get Twitter blue, I could care less about the blue tick. It's the fact that I think if you pay for it, you get a 30-second edit facility on Twitter. And I have to admit, that's like one of those things where I think that's, for someone who gets worked up as I do, it's probably almost worth that investment, because I'm sort of investing in my own career. But it's the reason I brought up the social media in terms of giving feedback is one of the things that we've been looking at in Apex is the ability from inside the product to give feedback directly, including actually, you know, logging bugs. So rather than someone going through an SR, if someone's using something in Apex Builder and they go, oh, this broke, they could push a button and say, okay, some details will be sent over to Apex. Now, that doesn't guarantee you get treated as an SR. It doesn't get guaranteed as a bug. It's just a way of saying, this is something I encountered. The Apex team might want to know about this. We have something similar in terms of a SQL test case, that the Optimizer SQL test case facility. What are your thoughts on the ability to have something like, for example, inside the database itself, where let's say you're on SQL Plus and you could say, I just got an error, an Aura 600, I want this automatically dispatched up to Moz. Do we actually have something like that? I think we used to, there was talk of it for a while.
Autonomous does. So if that happens to you on the Autonomous database, then it does automatically log a ticket and it says, oh, this customer's experienced an Aura 600 and here's what it is. And here's their details for the ops team that, and if it deem it, it becomes an automatic SR. So I think we're evolving to that, but none of the tools that I'm aware of have the button that says, hey, something funky monkey just happened to me. I want you, Oracle, to know about it. Here's all the details. But yeah, it does automatically happen on the Autonomous database today, for exactly that reason that you said, that we should be aware about what's going on and be able to take corrective action for that.
I suppose there's that problem of every time you offer a service where you're saying, we'll pick up some details of your database to help us make it better and send it to us, there'll be some people go, fantastic. There'll be others that go, no way.
Hell to the no.
I know every time I install Chrome or Microsoft Edge and the first pop-up says, you know, would you like to send diagnostic data to us to help us improve the product? I'm like, are you insane? Yeah, it's like, and then I'm on Twitter going, you know, you should send us a SQL test case. That'd be great. Yeah, it's like, Once again, the hypocrisy of my hat on, but not to worry. I've just clicked on your Twitter profile now. Uh-huh. You're at 9,677 followers. I know you track this rigorously.
Sure. Okay.
I can see on the back wall there, you've got a chart with your follower count per day. I should say just that that's fiction, by the way, for anyone listening. One would imagine you'll get to 10,000 followers very soon. Is it easy to get too wrapped up in this kind of stuff with social media? I know anyone introducing you at a talk would often say, here's Maria Colgan. She's hugely popular on Twitter, hugely popular blog, et cetera, et cetera. Is it easy to get wrapped up in the social media in terms of reach, or do you just do your best to keep it out of your head and just ignore it?
Honestly, the only people who ever seem to know the number, it's not something I focus on. So I don't change what I would put on Twitter or what I would put on Facebook or the blog or whatever for that. Most of the time, these things are reminders for myself that are going out, especially the blog posts. I tend to write articles and stuff about things that either somebody's asked me about or I'm trying to remember the details of. And it's always nice to be able to go back and look at those. I honestly, I don't think about it. I probably should. I should be more careful about what I put out now that you say that 9,000 and whatever number of people are going to see it. But it's no, it doesn't really appeal to me in that respect. Mainly because I suppose it's true on Twitter that because it's just text and it's not video content necessarily, it doesn't feel as personal. And certainly I know in the responses I've received from some folks that they don't realize there's a person behind some of this as well. But yeah, I haven't really paid much attention to it. Do you pay a lot of attention to the numbers? You've an even bigger following, I think.
I generally try not to, because I think that the moment you look at the numbers, then yeah, effectively your content will start skewing toward the numbers. And certainly if you start seeing my blog posts or tweets with an endless array of cat pictures, then you know that I've gone to the dark side. I'm going to call out Martin Widlake here. But Martin's a good friend, but yeah, he's got cats in his house and they make regular appearances on Twitter. But yeah, so that is obviously the secret to Twitter success.
Then I'm SOL. There isn't a single live animal in this house at all. At least you've got the dog. You've got a head start. There's neither cat nor dog in our house. So yeah, I'm out of luck on that. Maybe I can ask the neighbors if I can borrow their dog and put them on Twitter. But yeah,
I have to admit, as I look at my dog, if he was any more relaxed, he'd be a piece of carpet. So I don't think he's going to be a Twitter star for me. But I digress. We should move on. Interestingly, I can see here that, are you at home or at the office there?
I'm at home today. We're doing about 3 days a week in the office at the minute.
Okay. And that's where I wanted to move on to. When I used to go to Redwood Shores, which was maybe once every couple of years when I had a chance, with no disrespect intended, you were a bit like paint on the wall in the sense that you were always there in your office, always present. Yeah, I could wander around the office and it didn't matter. People would be out traveling, people would be working from home, but you were always there. In fact, I often used your office. I would go in and say, look, there's no spare offices. And you would go, well, I'm off to meet with someone, meet with a customer so you can use my office. And very grateful for that. Had you done a lot of remote work before COVID came along?
No. So I was never, as you so rightly pointed out, I was never a work from home kind of person prior to COVID. I was either on the road or in the office. At the time when we started, my husband and I shared a home office and my desk was never really used. He used to use it and worked from home a couple of days a week, but I never really used it. And after the first 5 days of COVID, my desk and my computer were ceremoniously or unceremoniously rolled out of the shared office and into the spare room where I am now, just because we realized two people on continuous Zoom back to back does not work, even with headphones and stuff. So yeah, but once I got set up, I actually quite liked it. I didn't think I would. I always thought I'd be kind of lonely at home, or as awful as it sounds, people who worked at home were busy doing laundry and making the dinner and weren't really working, was my mindset, which is why I was in the office, as you said, like the wall paint day and night. But actually, it turns out you can get just as much, if not more, done at home than I originally thought.
I have to admit, I find when I first started working with Oracle, I was 2 days a week in the office, 3 days at home. And when I went to the office, because the Perth office was predominantly pre-sales consultants, the office is deserted because they're all out talking to customers. So I'm sitting there going, I just paid $30 for parking. I'm sitting alone and the coffee's much better at home. And so I thought, I think we'll switch to 5 days. I was curious as to how you adjusted with that in terms of, I won't use the term social butterfly, but certainly whenever I was in Redwood Shores, you had 1,000 meetings on, 1,000 people to go visit, and you were wandering between offices, either telling people they'd done something wrong or getting advice on something or whatever, but you were out and about everywhere. Was it a tough adjustment to working at home alone?
So because of all the Zooms and because my husband had set me up with a really good video camera and stuff here, that I was instantly able to see people even when I came home, it wasn't as bad. In fact, we were nearly better behaved in a Zoom world than we were in person. Because in an in-person meeting, and I've noticed it since we've come back to the office, you'll have six simultaneous conversations going on around the table as people branch off to argue about something, where when we were on Zoom, we were much better behaved. And I think we listened to one another more frequently or better in that respect. But yeah, I was pleasantly surprised. I thought I would have a big issue with working from home and stuff, but I actually really enjoyed it. I liked it a lot. And that's why I haven't gone back to the full 5 days. It is still a little quiet in the office too. It's not back to full capacity.
Yep. Of course, being a remote worker doesn't absolve Maria from going into meetings with some of the most senior people in Oracle Corporation. In the next episode, we'll ask Maria what it's like to walk into a meeting with Larry Ellison in the same room. We'll also talk about some of the cool stuff coming in 23C. I hope you can join us. Thanks for listening to this podcast. The music credit goes to Zanman from Pixabay Music.